For much of his career, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Junot Diaz has written about a man named Junior.
He's a Latino. He's part of the African diaspora. He's an immigrant. He's a kid who grew up really tough in one of the poorest sort of backgrounds. He's like a kid who's super nerdy and ends up teaching at a university. He's sort of kind of a gruff, masculine kind of figure, and yet he's an artist.
This Dominican man who grew up in New Jersey is the protagonist in Diaz's first book of short stories and also the narrator of his novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. And now Junior is back in a new set of short stories called This Is How You Lose Her. This book took the author 16 years to finish, forcing him to struggle even as he published his other works.
You know, I had this idea for this weird hybrid novel-esque, story-esque compilation about the rise and fall of a young cheater, and it just took forever.
Cheater meaning that he cheats on the women in his life.
Oh, yeah, no, when I finished my first book, Drown, I realized that the theme of infidelity, which runs through the book, needed sort of a much more upfront presentation, and I concocted this project. It just really interested me. But, you know, sometimes you chart out a course and you think it's going to be an afternoon walk, and he realizes it takes you half your life.
Well, let's talk about who Junior is. First thing that he does in this book is get caught cheating on his girlfriend. One of the last things he does in this book is get caught cheating with 50 different girls on his fiancée. And there's a little bit of the same in between.
Yeah, and yet the progress of the character is kind of, I thought that it was really interesting because, you know, when you encounter Junior at the beginning, he thinks that, you know, all he has to do is sort of, quote unquote, fix the relationship. And what I mean by that is that if he really, really had that compassion, that this is a person, this is a human being that I've hurt, he wouldn't be so quick to scrub away his crimes. And I think that by the end of the book, we see a Junior that's completely different. The crime, the pain he has caused, the betrayal of a relationship of this woman, he can't escape. And in some ways, hits him in the heart with an almost fatal blow. And it's a very, very different character at the end, as far as his compassion, than who we're introduced to at the beginning.
He's actually capable of being punished for his crime, in effect. He's actually capable of punishing himself.
And I think that that's the most significant thing in the development of a person, especially a boy. Listen, I don't know where the majority of the men are listening to this grew up in or around, but I grew up in a world, very New Jersey, American, Dominican, immigrant, African-American, Latino world. And, you know, I went to school and it was basically the same. I went to college. It was basically the same, where largely I wasn't really encouraged to imagine women as fully human. I was, in fact, pretty much by the larger culture, by the local culture, by people around me, by people on TV, encouraged to imagine women as something slightly inferior to men. And so I think that a lot of guys, part of our journey is wrestling with coming to face our limited imaginary and growing in a way that allows us not only to imagine women as fully human, but to imagine the things that we do to women that we often do blithely without thinking, we just sort of shrug off, as actually deeply troubling and as hurting another human being. And this seems like the simplest thing. A lot of people are like, really? That's like a huge leap of the, you know, of knowledge or the imagination. But for a lot of guys, that is, man.
Now, let me ask about that, because there are women characters in your book who specifically ascribe that kind of blindness to Dominican men. Watch out for Dominican men. They're awful human beings. Do you think that's a Dominican thing, or you think it's a guy thing, a universal guy thing?
Well, you know, always the joke is, who's making that accusation? And I just think that for the group of women who are making this accusation, Dominican men are standing in as the male. But look, bro, are you telling me that if I get all the women of the United States and gather them all together and say, do you highly recommend American men, that you're going to get like a sterling recommendation, that these women are going to be like, oh, yes, American men are fantastic. These dudes have done so well by us. I think that every culture, if you got all the women of that culture together and say, grade your men, I don't think any country, even a place like Denmark, which has this famous sort of gender equality, would give their men anything higher than an F as a collective. And that's a reality. And I think something worth thinking about.
There's another aspect of Junior, and that is that he grows up kind of a nerdy kid. I mean, he's in this family that sometimes has difficulties. He's got an older brother who's working blue-collar jobs, but he's sitting there reading Roman history as a teenager, and he goes on to be a writer and a college professor. This is a smart kid who is still really, really struggling to figure out women and figure out the world.
This idea of what we say, figure out the world or figure out ourselves, that we're talking about wisdom. And listen, I teach at a place, I teach in a town where supposedly the most intelligent, brightest people come out of, are developed, and work. And
you're at MIT, correct?
I'm at MIT and I'm near Harvard. I have an affiliation with Harvard. And I got to tell you, there is absolutely zero correlation between intelligence and wisdom.
You've noted that he grows in a way, or at least he better understands what it is that he is doing to other people, particularly to women. But on the other hand, the book is called This Is How You Lose Her, and I don't think it's giving away too much to say that he's not going to find himself at the end in a lasting relationship, and it's not even entirely clear that he wants to be in a lasting relationship at the end. Do you think?
Yeah. I don't know if I would say that.
Go on.
I don't think that this book's representation of heartbreak would be so aching, would be in some ways so rough if this wasn't a person who was longing for love. And I think what we're left with at the end is certainly not the new relationship that would be the salvation. We're not left with this kind of typical American moment where we see him on a park bench meeting someone. But what we're left with is a character who, for the first time in his life, I would argue, is capable of being in a normal relationship, has the tools, has sort of the imaginary, has the heart necessary. And for a lot of people, they want to see the consummation. They want to see the end, him married. But for me, it felt as an artist, what mattered more was not that he found the love he wanted or that he's met the person, but that for the first time in his life, he's actually ready. This would be a person who could be in a committed relationship. And I felt like that was an enormous victory for him.
The latest book by Junot Diaz is called This Is How You Lose Her. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
And you can find an excerpt from that book at npr.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. As the U.S. intervention in Iraq moves from daily news to recent history, writing about the conflict is moving from daily newspapers to books. Now, so far, most of the books on that subject have been written by journalists or politicians, but a small number of Iraq military veterans are telling their stories in memoirs and also in novels. NPR's Quill Lawrence spoke with three veterans, authors of new books on Iraq, and brings us this report.
Iraq war veteran Brian Kastner opens The Long Walk with a direct and disturbing warning.
The first thing you should know about me is that I'm crazy. I haven't always been. Until that one day, the day I went crazy, I was fine. Or I thought I was. Not anymore.
Kastner worked in EOD, or Explosive Ordnance Disposal. He defused bombs in Iraq. But he returned home to a minefield inside his head. The title of the book, The Long Walk, is an old bomb squad term.
The literal meaning, of course, is when you put on the bomb suit and a single person has to walk up to the IED alone. In the EOD world, we call that the long walk. It's been called that for decades. The long walk at home, I'm not sure if it's done yet.
Back home in upstate New York, Kastner found he'd returned to an America untroubled by the war. He found himself paranoid. In a suburban shopping mall, he would catch himself looking for routes of escape or even how to kill his way out. Kastner suspects he's got brain injuries from hundreds of explosions on the job. He's lost beautiful memories from when his children were young, to have them replaced when some tripwire sets off a gruesome flashback to Iraq.
I wrote this book for my sons. Because when I wrote it, I had no agent and no publisher and no plan. I just knew I had a story that needed to come out, and I wasn't the father I wanted to be, and I wasn't the husband I wanted to be. And then, if nothing else, I'd print out one copy and stick it on the shelf and have it for my sons when they were older and ready to read it.
The result is a painful but compelling read, even as Kastner finds ways to cope, at least partially, with his long walk back at home.
Maybe it would be the continuing walk, the long walk that hasn't ended yet.
Are you still crazy?
Sure, because there's no cure for any of this. Do I feel that overwhelming pressure in my chest every second of the day? No, unfortunately, that's passed. But I'm planning on living my life with it from now on. I don't expect it to just not be there anymore someday.
Another book, The Yellow Birds, by Kevin Powers, also stitches together scenes from the war and an uneasy homecoming. The narrator is Private John Bartle, a grunt who fought in the villages of northwestern Iraq. At the end of his tour, he did something that seemed right at the time, but he now sees as a terrible transgression. Powers says he wanted to look at how these young men in uniform get in the habit of making snap decisions about life and death.
It is a kind of a rash action. I mean, it's not something that they spend a long time considering, whether it's an instinctive just kind of moment of this is what has to be done, and then they do it. And that may determine whether what you do is good or bad or not.
The main character's deployment to Iraq is a journey toward understanding the consequences of his actions and how very little he can control. It's fiction, and author Kevin Powers says that makes the story more intense than anything he experienced in Iraq. Powers has been writing poetry since before he joined the army, and it shows. The Yellow Birds is a short novel, but not a quick read. It's just shy of overwritten. The language is rich, worth slowing down to appreciate. Here's a passage.
Yeah, seems like we're fighting over this town every year. I thought of my grandfather's war, how they had destinations and purpose, how the next day we'd march out under a sun hanging low over the plains in the east. We'd go back into a city that had fought this battle yearly, a slow, bloody parade in fall to mark the change of season.
Powers says the book has no agenda, though his characters do convey futility more than any great purpose.
We'd drive them out. We always had. We'd kill them. They'd shoot us and blow off our limbs and run into the hills and wadis, back into the alleys and dusty villages. Then they'd come back, and we'd start over by waving to them as they leaned against lampposts and unfurled green awnings while drinking tea in front of their shops.
The tragic absurdity of Kevin Powers' book is in sharp contrast to the comic absurdity in another Iraq book. This one is about the little people who lived out the war in the comfort of forward operating bases, or FOBs.
They were FOBits because, at the core, they were nothing but marshmallow.
David Abrams is the author of FOBIT.
They cowered like rabbits in their cubicles, busied themselves with PowerPoint briefings to avoid the hazard of Baghdad's bombs, and steadfastly clung white-knuckled to their desks at forward operating base Triumph.
The funniest part about Abrams' book is that he isn't making it up. The FOBITs live on FOB Triumph, a name that seems Orwellian, not so different from the name of the FOBs where Abrams worked in real life.
As far as FOB Triumph is concerned, that's made up out of my mind. But there are similarities to Camp Liberty and Camp Victory, where I was on the Liberty Victory complex.
No one was allowed to say those names with irony, certainly not in the Army Public Affairs Shop where David Abrams worked for 10 months in 2005. Abrams says there were plenty of FOBITs whose jobs trapped them on the base, but they at least felt guilty about not being in combat.
You know, it's not like I really want to be out there in it myself, but at the same time, you know, you've got to think, wow, I'm sitting here at the desk, I'm comfortable, I'm in air conditioning, and they're out there in those conditions. You know, it's really creates kind of a conflict inside you.
FOBIT may fall short of classics like Catch-22, but Abrams is finally breaking the taboo on making fun of the war and the U.S. effort in Iraq, which provides plenty of fuel for satire. A writer who served in the Vietnam War, Tim O'Brien, said there are as many wars as there are soldiers who fought in them. These three books on the Iraq War are just the first look at what must be thousands of stories still to be told. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
And there are those who say the Great Recession, while taking a serious toll on men in the workforce, has actually given women more opportunity. After decades of men dominating most of the work world, there is growing evidence that the changing economy is beginning to favor women. Writer Hannah Rosen has documented this in her new book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. She joined us to talk about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
The notion of the end of men. Of course, at the heart of this is an economic story. Give us some statistics that have to do with most particularly the labor market.
So the latest job numbers show that men are at their lowest labor force participation rate since 1948. And the manufacturing economy has lost almost 6 million jobs. And just about the same number of jobs were added in the healthcare industry and the service economy, which are largely dominated by women. You can see right there that that creates a different kind of economy. If our assumption is that the men are the breadwinners, or in other words, if that's been our assumption for some tens, maybe thousands of years that men carry the family, when that dynamic shifts, you can see the relationships shift with it. So we have to redefine what we mean by head of the household, what we mean even by, you know, manly virtues and what women do and what men do and how marriage works and who raises the children. All these things start to change along with it.
Let's focus on one core aspect of what you're talking about here, and that is many jobs that were dominated by men that involved oftentimes, you know, physicality, brawn.
Right.
Have disappeared and probably for good
yes.
in this country. And women then having to fill in this space in terms of bringing home the bacon.
So we'll start with that initial fact. It's sad. I mean, it's a tragedy. And I think we're in a transition moment where men have to, you know, rethink what they want to do. And we as a society have to figure out what to do with that fact that a lot of men who are able to live a very respectable middle class and even upper middle class existence doing essentially brawn jobs can no longer do that. And so what do you do with that fact? I mean, you're not going to have every man become a nurse, you know, or every man become a profession that we consider feminized, because I think men are uncomfortable with that idea. So, you know, some of reporting this book made me feel really protectionist. Like, why can't we have those factories back in America? I mean, that's definitely one instinct I have. And I think that the million-dollar question for economists is why women have heard the call of the changing economy, why it is that they've been more flexible than men have been. That's like an essential quality I try and define in the book, which right now women have in greater degree than men.
So despite the fact that at this moment in time, women still generally make less on the dollar than men do, I think it's still 78 cents to the dollar. And despite the fact that whole swaths of the economy are still closed to women nearly, like corner offices, CEOs, Silicon Valley, tech jobs, very male-dominated, what are you seeing here? That you think you're seeing the future?
Yes, I think I'm seeing the future. It's only been, you know, 40 years that this has been happening. So I think it would be crazy to expect that the entire world flips upside down right away. But you do bring up the obvious issues. What happens at the top? It's obvious to me that people are still in this transition moment, somewhat uncomfortable with female power. And so one thing I do in the book is explain that, describe that, what this transition looks like, and talk to women who work in Silicon Valley, who work on Wall Street, in places where this transition is not complete, and see what their reality is like and how you move to the next level. So that's what I think the future is going to look like.
Do you imagine, say, in 10 years or 15 years, half a generation, that, say, Goldman Sachs would be run or dominated by women, or that Wall Street firms, generally speaking, say, would be half women and they would really be calling the shots?
I actually think finance is going to be the last one to go. They're going to hold on the hardest. I think finance is just very macho. I mean, that's just, you know, word on the street. That's what people tell me. You know, finance is the one that holds on the most tightly to its frat culture, basically. But I definitely imagine that for lots of other industries. I mean, if you look at someone like Marissa Mayer, who gets a CEO job at Yahoo when she is visibly pregnant and gets to say she doesn't want to take all that much maternity leave, whatever we think about that, it's wonderful that that model exists and that women can be that person because, you know, they're figuring it out. We're figuring it out.
Hannah Rosen is a senior editor at The Atlantic. Her new book is called The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon is now widely considered one of the best contemporary American novelists. And each time he releases a new novel, it becomes a kind of literary event. It's no different this time with his book Telegraph Avenue that comes out this week. His publisher has set up a record shop on Telegraph Avenue, and it's a replica of Brooklyn Records, the shop at the heart of the book. The novel tells a story of two couples, Nat and Aviva, who are white and Jewish, and Archie and Gwen, who are African-American. The two men are friends and co-owners of that record store that straddles the Berkeley-Oakland border, and Aviva and Gwen work together as midwives. The plot follows these and other characters and touches on issues of race, sexuality, and redemption. And Chabon says the way he came up with the idea was by first just imagining the world these characters inhabit.
In this case, the world was a very tiny one. The initial seed was planted when, sometime in the late 90s, I, having just moved to Berkeley, I walked into a used record store, and I was struck immediately on walking into this place, first, you know, overwhelmed by the incredibly nostalgic, powerful odor of moldering records. And then I looked around, and what I saw was two guys were working in the store this day. One was a black guy, one was a white guy. And their customers were all standing around hanging out, and they were black guys and white guys too. And just at that moment, I was caught with a sense of both of longing and of remembrance, because I grew up in the 1960s and 70s in a place not far from where you are right now, Guy,
in
a
Washington,
town called
D.C.
Columbia, Maryland. Mm. And Columbia was a planned community that was built in the 1960s and was intended to be a place where people of different races could live together, could find affordable housing, and young families could grow up together. And when I grew up there, it did a pretty good job of hewing to those ideals. And, you know, I moved many times after I left Columbia, and I encountered a lot of stark realities living in other parts of the country that made me realize what a sort of, in a sense, almost like a brigadoon, you know, like a little sheltered oasis Columbia had been. And when I walked into the record store, I just got a sense of return. And that was where it eventually emerged in the form of this book.
A lot has already been written about the music in this book. There's a lot of references to old school jazz and R&B, almost like there's kind of a film score or soundtrack behind or sort of embedded within the pages. How did you think about integrating music into the prose?
Well, I listen to a lot of music. I mean, I listen to music while I'm writing anyway. I haven't always listened to music, but as soon as it became possible to conveniently and easily take music with me onto airplanes, I began to listen to music while I worked. And what I discovered very quickly was that it was possible for me to program the music I listened to help get me into the proper frame of mind. So when listening to this book, when writing this book, I listened to lots and lots of music. And as I went along the journey with Nat and Archie to try to kind of figure out what kind of music it was that they were most passionate about, that they specialized in their vinyl record store, that they played in the band together, I discovered this subgenre or style of jazz, which became something that a lot of people call soul jazz and then transformed into something some people call jazz funk. What it really is jazz with the backbeat restored to a place of prominence so that you could dance to it. I guess the more saturated I got in it, you know, the more it worked its way into the book.
I know I've asked you about this in the past when you've been on the program, about your writing routine, because it's fairly rigid. You've talked about how you write sort of every day, Sunday to Thursday, 10 to 3 each day. But I was
10 p.m. to 3 o'clock in the morning.
Which is unbelievable. But I'm wondering how you actually constructed the sentences in this book. Because, I mean, I can open up any random page here and find something that just seems like it couldn't have been written quickly. Or did they come out quickly?
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You know, sentences are the purest, simplest, most pleasurable part of writing for me. And it's the part that comes the easiest to me. It is frequently the case that I, as I'm sitting and writing, I am hearing first this sort of advanced ghosts come after, so I can't think of whatever the opposite of a ghost would be, the harbinger of the sentence kind of begins to occur to me in a sort of empty rhythmic form that has no real meaning yet, but just is a series of pulsing future syllables and clauses that are structured with a certain kind of rhythm to them. And, you know, instantaneously afterwards, the sense of the sentence fills in that empty vessel. And I'm just struggling to kind of keep up with it and get it down. But there are plenty of other times where I'm just really working and working and working and working and trying to, I trample on that initial beautiful mystical sentence that emerged, and I kind of step on it, and then it gets broken, and I can't remember how it went back together again, and I have to try to keep fixing it and tinkering with it. And, you know, I love that aspect of it, the shaping of sentences, the crafting of sentences. That's the fun part of writing for me.
I'm speaking with the novelist Michael Chabon. His new book is called Telegraph Avenue. When you read, and maybe you don't, but I'm assuming that you must have come across at some point, somewhere where a critic has written, Michael Chabon, one of the greatest living American writers.
And I hate it when they say that.
And you've been on this program a few times, and I've met you, and you are a pretty regular guy, and I mean that in the most positive terms. I mean,
Thank you.
You do grocery shopping in Berkeley, but how do you feel when you read that stuff? I mean, you grew up in Columbia, Maryland, and a single mom, and here you are. Many, many critics believe that, and many readers believe you are among a handful of the greatest living writers in America.
You know, the truth is, the part of me that's walking around grocery shopping and stepping in dog poop that somebody would have to pick up and, you know, having to rush to get my kid at school, that part of me is so predominant, and I struggle so hard to sort of wrestle away from that side of my life to make space for the part of me that is just all about writing those sentences, that I don't know, there's not a whole lot left to spare. So I've always had a pretty powerful sense of who I am and what I want to do, and I know I can write, and I've known that since I was 10 years old, and I don't really think about it very much. I just do it. But all that being said, I have such incredible lingering after effects. Even at the age of 49, I'm going to be 50 next May, I still smart deep down inside every day from having felt like a doofus and a nerd and a geek, having been picked on and teased and everything from the time I was 10 years old to the time I was about 14 years old. The effects of that period have never gone away. You know, when I hear people giving me the kind of praise that you're talking about, as much as it's, you know, it's very nice and everything, but there's a deep, important, crucial part of me that just says, you know, it just washes over, and that part of me
that
says...
That you can't be that. You
you're still a loser, though. You're still a loser.
This book is out. It has been pretty well reviewed. A few sort of lukewarm reviews, but by and large... but by and large, they've been pretty amazing. Does that mean anything to you? Do you breathe a sigh of relief? I mean,
yes.
You do.
Yes. I mean, where there are certain crucial reviewers, all I feel on receiving a favorable notice is a profound, immediate, you know, almost like bladder-releasing sense of relief.
Even and though you've won the Pulitzer Prize, even though you've been...
It's not an act of pleasure by any means. I mean, it's a pleasure, but it's that kind of absence of a negative pleasure. It's just like, oh, thank God, I got past that one this time. It's about exhaling. You know, I can still remember almost verbatim negative criticisms that I got for my first book, Mysteries of Pittsburgh, in 1988. And I could not tell you for a second the corresponding words of praise that I might have received at the same time.
But reading what you've read so far, you can now breathe a sigh of relief.
A little bit. I'm exhaling just a little bit. But you never know.
That's author Michael Chabon. His new book is called Telegraph Avenue. He spoke to us from Youth Radio in Oakland. Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been great to talk to you again, Guy.
And if you want to read or download audio from Telegraph Avenue, go to our website where it's part of our new First Reads series. It's at nprbooks.org.
The Good Girls Revolt by Lynn Povich tells a story that was incredibly important to a certain group of women, a group that includes me and every woman who works in a news organization. The book is the story of, as the subtitle has it, how the women of Newsweek sued their bosses and changed the workplace.
and I'm here to tell you that they did change the world of women working in journalism. Lynn Povich is in our New York studio to talk about her book. Lynn, welcome.
Thank you, Linda.
Let me say right away that you and I know each other, and we have many friends in common. We're almost exactly the same age. We came to journalism at the same time with many of the same ideas and ambitions. We started with low-paying menial jobs and no prospects of advancement because women did not move up in journalism, and we were thrilled. How dumb is that?
We were so happy to be working in an interesting place, as you said, you know, surrounded and talking about the news of the day. Some women saw the lay of the land quite early, that they would never be promoted to writer or reporter. They would, as Jane Bryant Quinn said, end up checking men who were less talented than she. Women were hired on the mail desk to deliver mail, then to clip newspapers, and if they were lucky, became researchers or fact checkers. All of the writers and reporters were men, and everyone accepted it as that was the way the world was until we didn't. It suddenly dawned on us that, oops, there's something wrong with this picture here, and we have to do something about it. And it's illegal.
Well, that's the thing that I think is so remarkable. I mean, surely you knew that, right?
Well, we didn't know it, actually. The woman who started our little movement was a woman named Judy Gingold, and she was having a conversation with a friend who was a lawyer describing the situation at Newsweek, and the woman said, you know, that's illegal. And she had no idea. And she said, well, you know, I don't think the men know it's illegal. And she said, well, call the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And the woman said to her, yes, it's illegal. And Judy said, well, I think we have to tell the men. And the woman said, are you crazy? People don't want to give up power. If you tell them, they will promote two women, co-opt all of you, and it will be over. Your case is so clear-cut, you've got to do something. And so now Judy had a moral issue, and she came back and started organizing us.
So you started recruiting people to sign on to the lawsuit. And this is another part that is deeply and horribly nostalgic for me. You did a lot of your persuading in the ladies' room where you were not at all likely to encounter bosses.
We would sort of look under to see who was in the ladies' room, look under the stalls, and then we'd approach someone at the sink and say, you know, oh, I've got to check this story by so-and-so, and, you know, God, I could write it better than he does. And if the woman seemed to respond, then you'd say something like, we're thinking about doing something about changing the system. Are you interested? And one by one, we reeled people in.
So you brought the suit, but it didn't quite work.
A few women went to the bureau, but the women who tried out as writers all failed, we think, because the men didn't want them to succeed. And very little happened. And so we decided we had to hire another lawyer, and we hired Harriet Rabb, a brilliant young lawyer at Columbia who was running an employment rights seminar.
So you started over. You filed suit again.
Correct. Harriet put across goals and timetables, which were then increasingly in use in these cases, where we asked for a third of the reporters and a third of the writers to be women, and most important, a third of the researchers to be men, to integrate the category to show that this was not a woman's job. It was an entry-level job for anyone with those skills. And our final demand was that there be a woman senior editor. And they balked at this because it was management. We can't tell them who to put in management. And we just said, we're not signing an agreement where there's not a woman in the meetings where all the decisions are being made. And they promised to have a woman senior editor by the end of 1975. We gave them 2 years to find any woman they could to have in those meetings.
It was not that long ago. It's so amazing to think about it.
Well, I was told they approached Gloria Steinem, and she said to me, well, they probably came to me because I was like Jose Greco, the only Spanish dancer they knew.
Well, now, you begin your book by describing a lunch that you had with some young women from today's Newsweek who were feeling a little bit like you had.
Yes, it surprised me when I met these young women at Newsweek today because, you know, they were all super competent, been told since they were kids that they could do anything. And yet when they got into the work world after a year or two, they were suddenly feeling marginalized, that guys seemed to be getting better assignments, and young guys with equal qualifications or even less were somehow being promoted faster than they were. And they couldn't understand why, because this was post-feminism, the sex wars were over, we were all equal now. So it couldn't be that thing called discrimination. It must be them. They just must not be talented enough to move ahead.
So what does that mean? The more things change, the more they remain the same?
Well, I think it's more difficult for young women now because it has the air of equality. But when you look under the surface, of course, there's still hostile work environments. There's still not equal pay for women. Many of us thought these rights were secure, that we had won. And yet you see how threatened they are, both in the work world and with reproductive rights and violence against women. I mean, vigilance is necessary.
Lynn Povich's book is called The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. Lynn, thank you very much, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much for having me, Linda.